Welcome to A Brit in LA with star of stage and screen, Lauren Samuels. Each week, she'll be navigating different areas of the US entertainment industry after swapping London for La La Land. She'll be meeting inspiring figures who are achieving their own Hollywood dreams.
Hi guys, and thank you for being here for another episode of mine, and I hope your favourite podcast. Remember, I do want to hear from you, so if you've got any questions or suggestions about the show, please contact me via the website abritinla.fm. Now, let's meet my guest today. Hollywood Wonder Woman Alexa Jago produces award-winning films and finds financing for them too. She's a leading light of the British community here in Hollywood as a member of BAFTA North America's board of directors and comes from a background on stage and screen, acting in everything from the Rocky Horror Show to the Kevin Costner film Waterworld. Well, Alexa, what a pleasure to meet you and welcome to A Brit in LA.
Thank you. Lovely meeting you too.
Now, I've got to start by confessing, you're something of a role model to me because you started out in musical theatre acting in the UK, just like I did. And then you moved to America and achieved your Hollywood dreams. What inspired you to make the big move in the first place?
I don't know. We all have such a dream about Hollywood, don't we? I mean, my mother looked a little bit like Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, wow, really?
You know, very beautiful blonde. And she was an actress. And you know, the whole mythology of Marilyn Monroe and Hollywood and growing up as a little girl. And then, you know, my first mentor was Sam Spiegel, who was a producer of African Queen, Lawrence of Arabia, On the Waterfront. And he saw me in a play when I was a teenager, and he pointed at the playbill and he said, "Who is this girl? Bring her to my car," which was an old-fashioned Rolls Royce. It had the number plate Lucky One.
How cool.
Because he said that, you know, if I had a 16th of his luck in life, he'd never have to worry about me. But he told me stories about Hollywood and Marilyn Monroe and what he thought was her fatal flaw, and Elizabeth Taylor, and you know, convincing Marlon Brando to work with Elia Kazan, who was naming names in the McCarthy era, and how he would say, "Well, Marlon wants to meet with you." And he would say to Elia, "Elia wants to meet with you." And so he sat and made me watch all his films with him and sort of quizzed me on all these films. And so I think, like a lot of people, you know, if you think of the film business growing up, you think of Hollywood. Even though my father was, and my mother were theatrical people, you know, they were, my father was a theatre director and owned a drama school in London. My mother was a theatre actress.
But Hollywood came calling and you announced yourself to LA rather cleverly, I think, with a one-woman show named New Girl in Town, which I just love. What was behind that strategy to showcase your skills and story, and how did it work out?
Well, I had done musicals in England and I loved, you know, singing and dancing and everything. It was most fun. And then I came to Los Angeles for a quick trip and I was lucky enough to meet Scott Whitman, who works with Mark Shaiman, and they've done things like Hairspray and worked with Bette Midler. And, you know, so they were sort of Hollywood royalty. Incredibly talented. And they heard me sing in a club and they said, you know, we should do a one-woman show. And they'd done it for other people. And so they gathered together this amazing group of people. And I had Bette Midler's ex-Harlettes as my backup singer, Charlotte Crossley. I had four-piece bands and everything. And Scott just wrote it around me. So there were five characters. There was a girl in the 60s from London. There was a nurse in World War II. There was an aging French star with a tragic life, as she'd been so self-oriented that she's now all alone, and all these characters, and then chose the songs for them. And it was just, it rolled all my kind of archetypes of Hollywood as I'd grown up in, because the costumes were all very 50s that we came up with. So it was kind of like a mixture of Rita Hayworth, Marilyn Monroe, all mixed into one.
Wow, so you just got to play all of the different characters. How did it go?
I mean, I always say it's one of the most rewarding things I've ever done. Went really well. we had lots of people come to see it, like John Travolta, which, you know, I was like, oh my God.
Stop, really? I love that.
Yeah, so I did it all over LA.
That's incredible and so brave to come over here. And the first thing that you're going to do is a one-woman show, which is, you know, quite a feat in itself, isn't it? To have to learn it all as well and just, you know, keep it there in the memory. No, you don't think about it, but wow, how am I going to learn all of those lines?
Oh, now I would. I'd be going, oh my God, how do I learn it all?
We spoke just now about your parents, and you sort of, I suppose, were born into this business, really, as your parents, as you said, owned and ran the Webber Douglas Academy of Dramatic Arts, which turned out so many future stars. Was there ever any consideration given to you doing something else other than showbiz?
Oh, my parents would always say, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I'd say, I want to be an actress. They'd go, yes, but what do you want to do when you grow up? It was the last thing on the, possibly on the list, because they knew how hard it is. You know, they knew that the percentage of people that make it is small and it's a tough life. Yes, I was good at biology and I went to Columbia University in New York and I was pre-med and my parents were deliriously happy. And then I was doing my chemistry midterms and I was cast, I was auditioning for Gwendolyn in The Importance of Being Earnest in New York. And I was lying on my bed and I thought, okay, I can either learn this audition and learn this part or I can study for my chemistry midterm. So I can't do both. So I picked up the chemistry book and I threw it across the room. And that was the moment I made my decision. I'm not taking the safe road.
Wow. How did your parents feel about that?
I can't remember, really, at that point. I think, you know, as like most parents, if they realise that it's a real passion and it's not something that you just think is kind of fun. I mean, it was a different age. I don't want to date myself, but there was no sort of instant stardom, Kim Kardashian type of life.
As you say, it was in your blood. They always do say that if you really don't love this industry and have to do it, then do something else, right? Because it's difficult. You have to have a really thick skin. One of the first Hollywood movies that you acted in was Kevin Costner's Waterworld, which was, I suppose, seen at the time as, you know, costly, confusing, maybe a bit of a failure, but has since been reassessed as a kind of ahead of its time cautionary tale about global warming. What was it like to be on that set?
I just done Comedy of Errors, where, of course, with Shakespeare, you better get every single word right. And I was rushing to England with my dogs. And suddenly I was told, I think it was David Rubin, was doing the auditions. You've got to come in now. And I said, I can't, I'm going to the airport. Anyway, I would drag my dogs into the audition and got the part. And it was shooting in the Big Island in Hawaii. All I remember is Kevin Costner, I mean, he is a movie star, isn't he? I mean, he just talks, looks, he's just such a gentleman, wonderful person to work with, for the first person you work with on film. And he kept saying, Alexa, you know, if you don't like the lines, just ad lib and we'll write it. And I was like, okay, coming from Shakespeare, it's like completely different. Yeah. He was great. He kept saying, move this way, you know, get the pretty one in the shot. And he bring it down, bring it down, bring it down. Because I'd just been doing Shakespeare in theatre. He kept saying, you know, make it smaller, make it smaller, make it smaller, make it smaller.
They always say that about TV, don't they? Make it smaller, make it smaller.
It was great. And when you say it was a failure, I mean, actually, it did make a lot of money. It was the biggest budget film of all time.
Yeah, I mean, wow, it was huge.
And then it has made a lot of money internationally. So I think in America it wasn't quite successful, but internationally it was.
And how do you feel about the film now?
Well, I mean, it was sort of before its time,
it
as you said.
Yeah.
Revolutionary.
Amazing. And you got to go to Hawaii. And I can't get my head around the fact that your first film was with Kevin Costner. How did you feel about that? I mean, were you very nervous?
I mean, obviously it wasn't a huge role, but yeah, pretty surreal. And I was very lucky, really, because he's the type of person that puts everybody at their ease.
Oh, that is so nice, because I would have been so nervous. You did plenty more acting in Hollywood in film and TV, and then you switched over to producing. How were you able to make that change, and why did you?
I think my father actually said to me, you know, you are a producer, don't you? Because you're naturally putting people together all the time and coming up with ideas and that's really producing. And so you should, you know, formalize it, professionalize it. And so I was in a movie with Hamish McAlpine, who's a British producer, who had a company at the time called Tartan Films, which was Ted Bundy, which was a serial killer movie, and he'd done three. This was, I think, was the third. Oh, it was the second. Anyway, after doing that, we decided that maybe I'd be an executive producer on his next movie, Hillside Strangler, and then from there helped John Steinfeld put together a movie called Detention, produced that, helped write it. And then when my father got ill, I went back to England and I started just helping a lot of charities, kind of, it just sort of fell into it. And I met so many people through those charities that were family offices, ultra high net worth individuals, all this type of thing. So I then sort of, one of my third charities was helping to set up this charity called Caring for Courage for the Royal Scots Dragoon Guards with the Duke of Kent and Prince Pavlos and the Colonel of the regiment. And so I got kind of known in the city of London as the military girl. And that's how I got involved in what's called in America, Kilo 2 Bravo. And in England, it's called Kajaki, the True Story, because they were trying to get funding for that. And so the two sort of producing films and raising money for the British military sort of joined perfectly in that film.
That is so interesting. And do you still have a passion for acting?
I do. I mean, because it's much more of the pure art form, isn't it?
Right. Yes, absolutely. I feel like it can never leave you, right? It's like we said earlier, it's in your blood. What kind of stories do you like to tell as a movie maker? Where does your passion lie?
Well, I mean, I have got a lot of passion about the troops, military, whether it be American or British, although it's been mostly focused on British, because their long-term welfare, that they tend to go off and do these amazing things. And it's not political because they just do what they're told and then they're forgotten very often. So I like to tell stories that have some kind of a message, which is why Kilo 2 Bravo was great, because the script was a very, really good script, but it was written heavily, heavily on conversations with the real soldiers. So when they sing Happy Birthday, when they're all in the desert thinking they're dying to one guy, that really happened. So most of the things in that movie really happened, and they really did say those things. And at the moment, I'm working, optioning a book called Bloods about the Vietnam War from the African-American perspective, which has sort of not really been told apart from Spike Lee's The Three Bloods. So that, I think, is a really important story that needs to be told. Also working on a human rights film. So, you know, and there's also a comedy. So, I mean, I used to do as an actress a lot of comedy.
Oh, did you? So you like comedy?
I mean, a lot of my roles were comedic. So I don't know quite how I got into this sort of heavy stuff. Maybe you get a little older. You think, oh, I should be saying something. There needs to be a message.
Yes. I should be more serious now. Well, but there's still comedy in there. Having built an impressive network of contacts in your Hollywood career, you were able to build on that to expand into financing films, heading your own company, launching a film fund, which is all so impressive. But what I want to know is, how do you get people to part with their money for such an uncertain investment as film?
In the military charity side, the colonels and the generals used to call me their secret weapon, because I was only allowed to go in when they had failed. So they would go in first, the big whales, as they would call them. And when they were turned down, then they would send me in. And I was guilt, really. I would say, do you have a son? Imagine him, you know. And I would just come in and they'd go, please leave, Alexa, here's a check.
Guilt, yes.
And then with film, I mean, we can all relate. I think a lot of people have a dream, telling stories. People, it's so romantic, catches people's imagination. So if you really believe in something and you've got people around you that know what they're doing, then we all love film.
We do.
Always shocks me when they don't.
How? I know, how?
What do you mean you're not interested?
It's the same as music when people don't love music as well. I'm like, what do you mean you don't love music or film? You know, I suppose we're in the entertainment industry, so we just love it all.
And then, of course, my father always used to say, you know, it's show business. It's 90% business and 10% show. Because, I mean, especially with the numbers involved in films, of course, there's a whole way of raising films and There's a whole formula.
Yeah, well, I am not very good at the business side. I must confess, I'm just the show. I'm the 10%. I am just the show. Tell me about your interesting journeys around the world, putting together financing for films and other projects.
Well, so I looked at the slate deals that were being done for studios, which pre-COVID was sort of like the big boys and the major six. And I thought, oh, this has all been done by men. Maybe
sure.
It could be done by a woman in a different type of a way. Let's just put it that way. And so I thought, well, my relationships with studio heads and people at studios, I could parlay that with my relationships of family offices and institutions in England and outside of England, all over the world. I had a wonderful lawyer called Chris Hansen in England who introduced me to people in China. And so most of the money that we raised in the structuring that we did for our slate deal for studios was from the rest of the world, not from America. So it was for American studios, but the money was from the rest of the world.
Wow, it's so interesting that you've travelled all over the place, you know, talking to people, well, sweet-talking them or guilt-tripping them, I suppose, as you said earlier. I mentioned you're also on the board of BAFTA in North America. What does the Academy do out here to support new and existing entertainment industry talent?
There's a lot. I mean, BAFTA in North America has many programs. We are a charity, and a lot of people don't realize that we're a charity. And the charitable work is done. It's very effective at getting unemployed people and disenfranchised youth into paid employment in the film business. So we do that with an outreach, and we have scholarships. BAFTA North America, BAFTA Los Angeles, which then became BAFTA North America, does a lot. So it's very supportive of young talent.
Yeah, I think it's so very impressive how they support emerging talent. You know, there's not enough of that. Giving the support to people that are, you know, already very successful, sure, but it's great that BAFTA are here helping people who are just rising up into the industry as well. In that way, BAFTA serves as kind of a mentorship function in some ways. How important a role have mentors played in your success? I know you mentioned a mentor at the start, but who are some of the ones that have helped you find your way?
Well, Sam Spiegel was the first one. He's a legend and had just the most amazing, very, very, very bright guy, plus huge talent and taste. But he didn't start making films till he was 40 years old. In fact, I just met with the Sam Spiegel Film School and told them that I knew him and everything. They were very excited. And then when I came to Los Angeles, I met Ron Meyer, who started CAA with Mike Ovitz and then went on to run Universal Studios for a long time. And he was mentor to me here. And I used to think it was just me that was so special. But in fact, everyone I know who's ever met him says exactly the same thing, is that he had a thing where he never treated anyone differently. He always calls people back. And he has a list and he always calls them back before the end of the day if he can. And he treats everybody as if, you know, tomorrow they could be the next big thing. He doesn't treat people in the classic Hollywood way. He's extremely disciplined, great taste, amazing decision maker. He could, I mean, anytime I had an issue, Ron could fix it. You know, I mean, he was just an incredible, incredible person to learn from the business side. And also, obviously, you know, his judgment on films as well, excellent.
Wow. I mean, you're lucky to have had such an amazing mentor in your life.
My father was also my mentor.
Yes, of course.
As most girls will say.
With all that you've achieved already in your amazing career, what ambitions remain? I know you spoke about some of the projects in the pipeline, but what huge ambitions remain for you?
Well, you know, I just want to continue making films that mean something, and my charitable work. You know, when you do charitable work, it means so much. It's so fulfilling. So anything that I do that can have a charitable angle, like that's why Kilo 2 Bravo, Kajaki, The True Story was such a great thing, because 100% of the premier money went to Royal British Legion, the Afghan Trust, Help for Heroes, Combat Stress, you know, this type of thing. So I love to be able to put those two things together. Always looking for, you know, great stories of the human spirit and highlighting things that aren't quite so good. that people will know about, like this human rights film. Would never say no to acting again either.
Really? Oh, good. I love that.
You never know. And then also a new girl in town, the one woman show, we thought of maybe doing the not so new girl in town.
Yeah, I love that idea. Oh, my goodness. Although you did say earlier that you might have trouble remembering it all now, you know, doing a one woman show.
That's the only thing.
Well, I love that idea. Yes, I say green light that. Green light that. What are some of the important lessons that you've learned on your journey through show business?
Things take longer than you think.
Yes.
You know what we were saying before, 10 years overnight success.
Yes.
It is a relationship business. It is a community. I mean, that's one of the things about BAFTA is that it really is a community here in Los Angeles, sort of a home. Really, I learned a lot from Ron in the fact that, you know, always call somebody back, treat everybody the way you'd want to be treated. Be disciplined. It isn't, you don't just sit around. Well, actually, what he said to me in the when I first met him was, he said, look, Alexa, the industry has changed. This was a long time ago. He said, the industry has changed. You can't sit around and wait to be discovered or for an audition or anything like that. You have to be proactive. Go off and do a short. I'm also on the board of the Holly Shorts Film Festival, which is Oscar qualifying. And a British actor, Riz Ahmed, The Long Goodbye was his film short that won last year. So, and these shorts are amazing. You know, Ron said to me, go make a short, promote yourself, but create, be proactive. And now, of course, everybody can make a film in 5 seconds on their phone, but you have to be really proactive.
Well, that's very good advice because you're right. You know, you could just sit at home waiting for the auditions to find you, which, of course, never happens. You know, a watched phone never rings. I've got a bit of an off the cuff question for you now. You were cast as Princess Diana in a film which was never released for sensitivity reasons as it wrapped just as she sadly died, which, of course, that was an understandable decision. But how disappointing was it that the world didn't get to see your performance in such an iconic role?
I know. I remember going in for the audition and when I walked in, there were these people sitting behind a table and they all kind of went, they all gasped. So I had sort of channeled her. I'd met her. I played Diana, not Diana, but I played a character called Diana in the Westminster Theatre in London. And Downton Abbey was shot at this castle where we rehearsed. And the Earl, the old Earl at the time, used to always call me Diana. And I'd say, no, actually, I'm Alexa. He'd go, no, Diana, darling, Diana, darling. But anyway, so I kind of channeled her. When I walked in for the audition, they went, and then I knew the minute I walked out, I thought, I've actually called Ron and said,
I've booked that.
And they called me in the car. You know, I was only just fresh here. As I was driving back, I got the phone call saying, I got it. But then, of course, I mean, I remember being dressed up as her and people being blocks away down the street, sort of turning around and just having a tiny feeling of what it must be like to have that level of fame. That one person that would see you from blocks away would talk about that for the rest of their life. You know, I saw Diana when, you know what I mean?
That's so true.
That you change people's lives just having met them for one moment and absolutely no privacy. And then walked into, I think it was about 6 o'clock in the evening and walked into the apartment and the television was on and it said something about Dodi El Fayed and the car accident and Diana had broken her arm. And I was like, oh my God, I've got to call my parents. And they were asleep, you know, and I said, I think Diana, and then later we found out she had died. It was just the most bizarre thing. The other thing that was really bizarre was that people were calling me up going, I'm so sorry to me, you know, because I was playing her and I was like, well, it's got nothing to do with me, but it was very bizarre having studied and being in that character. And then she died.
It must have felt like losing a part of yourself in a way. You know, you'd spent so much time focused on this character. Just talking about it now, you know, it brings tingles. You know, what an honor, what an absolute honor to have had that opportunity to play that wonderful woman in your career. Before we finish, I want to go back to musical theatre. Obviously that's where I began. How difficult do you think it is for people to transition from musical theatre to Hollywood?
Well, you know, as I say, I did my one woman show. I mean, I was very lucky to have met Scott Whitman, so one of the most talented people in the business, and he wrote and directed New Girl in Town. So I was able to take that. It was almost like an audition piece. In fact, there was a director who saw it one night who said, you know, I wanted to be in this film. Bring her over tomorrow. So I went to meet the director the next day and was standing, and somebody had sent him a recording of the show, and we're standing together watching it. And he turned to me and she said, she's fantastic, isn't she? When's she coming in? I said, no, that's me. And he went, how long ago was this taped? Last night. He's like, what? And he made me go away and come back in costume because I totally transformed myself to this really sort of va-va-voom, you know, Rita Hayworth, Marilyn Monroe type with the false eyelashes and everything else and the bustiers. So me being normal didn't quite have the same impact.
Stop. I love that.
Yeah. I mean, be proactive.
Yeah. There's a belief that there's not much theatre here in Los Angeles, but there is.
There is. I did a lot of theatre when I first came.
Yeah, there is. And I also think perhaps in America, people don't just see you as, you know, just a musical theatre performer.
No.
Maybe quite as much as they do in the UK. You know, you don't get pigeonholed as much.
I mean, I don't want to say that it's looked upon slightly as an audition for a film or, you know, I mean, but it's not. Theatre in London is theatre for itself. And of course it is here in Los Angeles as well. But I think a lot of people think maybe I'll be seen for X, Y and Z. So, it, you know, I don't think you'll be, nobody's going to look at you and think, oh, she's musical.
Yeah, or she's MT. What would you say has been the sort of most challenging or character building experience that you've had in Hollywood?
I mean, there is an enormous amount of competition.
Yes, a thick skin. As we said earlier, you've got to have one.
Yes, not everybody's. I mean, Ron Meyer, the reason why he was thought so highly of and did so well in the industry was because he's unusual. You know, you don't often get people who are that consistent and want to develop people. So the business side of it's pretty tough.
Yeah, it is. It is. It is tough. I said to someone not long ago, you know, you maybe have 20, 30, 40, even 50 auditions and maybe you'll book one role, you know? Yeah, it's very challenging. As someone who is very much following in your footsteps, what advice would you give to me, having done musical theatre in the UK, but now looking to make my mark here in Hollywood?
Well, as I say, be proactive. You know, you might want to do a one-woman show.
Yeah, I love this idea.
But shoot
now.
It. When I say shoot it, I don't just mean shoot the live performance. I mean, you could make a short of that and use your musical theatre as well and build it all into something. So it's a story that uses all your talent within film as a short, because I think shorts are getting more and more useful, and BAFTA has shorts and they have to be British. In BAFTA, they need to be, it's the only category that needs to be British is short.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And you're British.
I am.
So I would say you just have to be proactive and create your own content as much as possible, whether it be live or recorded.
Yeah, it's great advice, being proactive, because as we said earlier, you can't just sit and wait for things to come to you. You know, now you can shoot anything on an iPhone. You know, iPhones are good enough. And, you know, you've got a couple of lights at home, which you have to have now anyway for self tapes. So there you go. Wow, I need to go home and write a short.
Write a short that adds in all of your talents.
Right. Well, that has given me some vigour. I need to go home and do it now. Alexa Jago, thank you so much for being my guest on A Brit in LA. It's been so fantastic to hear your story.
Thank you very much.
After recording this episode, I chatted to my best friend back home, singer and actor Noel Sullivan of Hearsay fame, all about my interview with Alexa. Here's what we had to say. Alexa said when she first came over to LA, she did like a one-woman show to sort of like introduce herself to
classic.
LA.
That's
how
classic.
Classic is that?
Yeah, that feels
the
like
balls.
Something.
So I'm just gonna stop.
Was she a comedian before? Or did she just or no, was it not even a show? It's not even a show like funny. It's like here is a dramatic piece, here is a dramatic monologue. Maybe with a sprinkle of interpretive dance.
It was everything. Yeah. She, well, obviously I didn't get to see it because it was a while ago, but she said it was everything, like musicals, dancing. She played loads of different characters. So she got to do all these different parts,
wow.
Got an agent from it, like got auditions.
Oh
like
my
it was,
God.
What a good idea.
Well, that's like, I'm going to Hollywood to capture my dreams.
I think she just smashed it, smashed it. And now I sort of like want to steal the idea, but it's too late.
No, you could do it again.
Write me a one-woman show, Noelle.
Okay.
What would be the premise?
young musical theatre starlet, takes to the streets of Hollywood, launches a podcast, then gets a job at, I don't know, The Grove?
The only thing you can name in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah.
The Grove.
The Grove.
The Grove. Yeah. But yeah, no, I do. I want to do a one-woman show, Noel.
Great.
Now, having spoken to Alexa.
Tell me more about Alexa.
Oh, she was fabulous. You know, when you meet somebody and you're like, oh my God, I'm not as posh as you or as like put together.
That's how that's everyone you meet, isn't it?
It's true. Yeah. When you've got a bit of a Midland accent.
I feel your pain.
She was so classy, you know, like beautiful. Oh, and she was in, this is an interesting fact. She was in her first ever acting job was opposite Kevin Costner in Waterworld. Do you remember that?
Yeah, of course. Well, I remember Waterworld, slammed by the critics.
I know. Well, we spoke about that. Yeah, slammed by the critics. But can you imagine that just being your first job, just flying off to, I think she said they shot it in Hawaii.
Yeah.
With Kevin Costner.
On that amazing set that they built, like that floated in the sea.
Yeah.
Can
you imagine that being your first job?
Yeah, and then being so like, oh yeah, I'm in a Hollywood movie, and then like, oh no, they got panned so hard.
No, I know.
But hey, at least she was in a Hollywood movie, which is
acting opposite Kevin Costner, who she said was absolutely charming and lovely and like really nice and was very like,
well, he was like the hottest of the moment in the 90s, wasn't he? I mean, like Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and
sexy Kevin Costner. This has taken a turn.
Why is your podcast suddenly like an AMSR? What's it called?
ASMR?
Sexy Kevin Costner. It's so weird.
But yeah, no, she was talking, obviously now she produces films and finds funding for films. And we were talking about how show business itself is mainly business and not much show. And sure. I'm not good at the business side, I have to confess.
Yeah.
Well, I'm show.
Well, I think like you find that people who go into production have like a better balance of the two things, the creativity and the business acumen to balance the books and think about the costs of production and all that stuff. And then there are other people who are entirely rubbish at numbers.
like me.
Yeah, but then the creativity side is usually heightened. Yeah.
You see, I'm just jazz hands. I'm just... teeth. I was going to say.
You can't say that. Teeth. You're just teeth.
Anyway, she made me feel like I need to write a one-woman show, be better at doing business, be as beautiful and successful. And that's what I'm going to do, Noel. So off I go.
Great. This podcast is really good for your self-esteem, I think.
Well, guys, that's it. You've been listening to A Brit in LA with me, Lauren Samuels. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you to my guest, Alexa Jago, and of course, my mate, Noel Sullivan. As usual, if you've enjoyed the podcast and you're listening on Spotify or Google Podcasts, then click those little cheeky 5 stars. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Audible, then get clicking on those keys and leave a review of the show. I would absolutely love to hear what you think of A Brit in LA and what you would like to see from the show in the future. And remember, if you've got a question for me or maybe even Noel, then please ask it in the contact section of the show's website, abritinla.fm, and we're going to be answering them on air in a special episode coming soon. Remember to share a link with your friends, give us a follow on socials. We're at @abritinla_pod. Have a most excellent week until we meet again, and remember, wherever you are in the world, go for your dreams. TTFN, friends.
Well, wasn't that amazing? It was created and produced by Podcast Partners. They're really lovely people and rather good at all this podcasting guff. Find out more at podcastpartners.com.